KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law in Greensboro, North Carolina, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School. Today I'm very excited to have on Jaime Cascio, author of the book Hacking the Earth, Understanding the Consequences of Geoengineering. From time to time on the show, we've had on scientists and people that discuss science in particular, as opposed to the more general topic that we discuss on the show, which is the internet and internet and communications technology. But in Jaime's book, he takes a very close look at what we call geoengineering, which I'll allow Jaime to define shortly, but boils down to efforts by humans to affect our environment directly, to change what the environment looks like and what ultimately we do with it. The genesis of this issue, at least today, is the global warming patterns that we see established more and more by science. And the book then focuses on how we might hack that problem, how we might address it by developing technologies that address directly some of the patterns of global warming, and what options we ultimately have and how successful they will be. The politics, the ramifications, and so forth are all discussed in this very readable and very sobering book. We're going to discuss today not only what is geoengineering, but what scenarios Jaime sees as the possibilities vis-a-vis global warming, how technology can play a role, and other issues that boil down to how we're going to address this issue. It's obviously one, at least I say obviously, although unfortunately there's a strong debate about whether it's so obvious, but it seems pretty compelling to me that there's an obvious problem, and it's one that we need to address in fairly short order, although Jaime has some insights there as well. By way of background, Jaime was selected by Foreign Policy Magazine as one of their top 100 global thinkers. And he writes at this intersection of emerging technologies, environmental dilemmas, and cultural transformations. His work has appeared in a variety of print media, ranging from Metropolis to the Wall Street Journal. He's the author of a few books, and he speaks on these issues regularly. I am excited to have Jaime on the show today. And so without further introduction, Jaime, thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture.
Thank you very much for having me.
Jaime is joining us via Skype. From I believe his home, and yes. this show is being recorded on February 21st for airing on February 22nd. So Jaime, give us a bit more of your background. What is the genesis of this project, the project that led to Hacking the Earth? And I know it's a series of previous essays. Perhaps you can talk about that and why you chose to write it.
Well, and by way of background, I usually describe myself as an easily distracted generalist. I've done academic work in history and evolutionary anthropology and global politics with a focus on national security. I've worked in the realm of field of computers. I'm interested in just about everything, and it turns out that the perfect job for someone who's interested in just about everything is actually that of a futurist. So for the last 15 years or so, I've been working professionally in the realm of what is sort of soberly called foresight strategy, but most people know as futurism. Now, that doesn't mean saying this is what will happen. Here's a prediction of what will happen tomorrow. These days, foresight work, futurism, generally means let's think about the implications of present-day decisions going forward. It's sort of a history in reverse. So in that context, I've been looking at the interesting intersections of seemingly diverse and superficially unrelated phenomena. And one of the things that emerged from that was this project called worldchanging.com back in 2003. A colleague of mine, Alex Steffen, and I started World Changing, and it, you know, mostly as kind of a let's start a blog, hey kid, let's put on a show kind of thing. And it very quickly turned into what was for a while the number one environmental website. And we had a book come out with a foreword by Al Gore, and lots of work on this, on the question of what are the solutions out there? What are the things that we can do to deal with these really big questions around global change, particularly around environmental change? And so in the course of all of this work and research and writing, I stumbled across in 2004 some fairly provocative arguments that what we might end up having to do to deal with global warming is something very big. And that is to make large-scale, planetary-scale changes to the essentially global ocean climate system in order to create changes in the impact on humans and human civilization. The version of the story that was popping around in 2004 was that we'd have to put up giant space mirrors to reflect a small portion of incoming sunlight. And that's all nice and science fiction-y, but way too expensive to be even plausible. But over the course of a few years, I started to see much more serious, much more grounded arguments about what might be done. And it struck me that this was moving very quickly from being kind of a fringy thing to being something that should be taken seriously. Now, geoengineering, this notion of doing large-scale changes to the planetary system, is one of those things that a lot of people, their immediate reaction is hubris. How dare you think that scientists know enough to do that kind of thing? The other reaction that people often have is, great, that means we don't have to make any other changes to our carbon output, et cetera. And both of these are wrong, mm-hmm. I think. What is being said now, and there are some very serious people taking up this idea at fairly high levels, not just in the U.S., but in the U.K., other parts of Europe, and China, I think in Russia, and in the non-governmental sector as well, we are at this really unfortunate intersection of two very powerful forces. One is that climate disruption is taking place far faster and with far greater intensity than had been projected initially. And it looks like we're going to be hit really hard in the very near future. In fact, we're starting to see those indications now. The other powerful force is this foot dragging on the part of political leaders around the world. Unwilling to make changes in the present in order to affect things in the future. So these two forces come together in a way that would have a very great likelihood of making a fix like geoengineering. We can talk a bit about what that might look like, but some kind of big fix make that look very attractive because it can be done fairly quickly and would delay the onset of the worst effects of global warming ostensibly long enough for us to get our house in order and to make the big changes to economic, urban, and technological systems and energy systems to get away from the carbon economy.
That's
a short recap there.
Yeah. No, that one of the nice things about this format is that you can give those answers. In most other interviews, we'd say, thank you, Jamais, for joining us today on the show. What you're talking about there, gets to, the broader questions that I want to talk about in a moment. You have run this, your writing in this area, and other writing through a website called Opening the Future. Can you tell the listeners what Opening the Future is and what the title means?
Well, it's just to quickly clarify, it's Open the Future.
I apologize. Open the Future.
That's okay. Open the Future. It really, the website Open the Future is just my solo think tank. It's the place where I've been putting up essays and ideas about what's happening in the world and what's likely to happen in the years to come. And the phrase comes from actually an essay that I wrote for what was supposed to be the final issue of Whole Earth magazine back in 2003. And it was the unpublished issue, final issue. And it was essentially arguing that a lot of these big problems that we're wrestling with globally, especially the ones that have a technological element, are the kinds of problems that our instinct seems to be to try to restrict information about, but we're actually much better off opening information, because these are the kinds of problems that are likely to require a very broad, diverse set of minds to come up with really innovative responses to. And the more we try to restrict knowledge about biotechnology or nanotechnology, or you know, sort of go down the list of interesting emerging techs, the more likely it is that we'll find ourselves in a position where something bad has happened and not enough people know how to deal with it. And so it's essentially making the argument that openness, transparency, is a much more powerful tool for resolving emerging, for dealing with emerging risks than is control and secrecy.
So that's a that's a topic of particular interest to me, and one that I write about in the context of IP lawmaking as well as trade secrecy and the use of trade secrecy law to prevent the disclosure of information to public that the public arguably does have a right to know under basic theories of democracy. With regard to the issue, however, of pooling minds in order to solve problems, you and I'm curious to get your perspective on this. How is the global warming crisis one such area, and to the extent that there are downsides to having such transparency, what do you see as the biggest downside?
Well, when thinking about transparency and global warming, one thing to be to be clear about with global warming, or I usually like to call it climate disruption, because I think that's the most accurate way to describe it, is that there's not going to be a magic bullet. We're not going to have one big change that's going to fix everything, forever. Instead, it's going to require a very, fairly large number of incremental, additive, and overlapping solutions. Changes to different aspects of how we design our cities, changes to how we get around, changes to what kind of energy we use and what that, just precisely what that will entail. We're talking just about solar or solar and wind and hydrogen, et cetera, et cetera. The point of all of this is that each of these innovations, while certainly great in and of themselves, have the potential to work much better and to be much more effective in dealing with this big problem if the people who are behind them can share ideas. And if we enlist the minds of people everywhere to be be contributors to the future, essentially. And so just in that general sense, how we deal with something as big and complex as global climate disruption, we really need a big, complex response. Now, in particular with geoengineering, my argument for transparency is a little bit more pointed in that I suspect that there are so many opportunities for misuse of geoengineering technologies that we're far better off having these programs be as open and transparent as possible to avoid governments or private actors feeling that they can get away with something, or to be able to identify unintended problems as early as possible. So, in talking about geoengineering, what the big problem is, what it boils down to, is who controls the thermostat. If you can change global temperatures, which is what most of these geoengineering projects want to do, is they want to put something into the sky. Usually, these days, most people are talking about putting sulfur dioxide precursors into the stratosphere to block out a small percentage of incoming sunlight to keep temperatures down. But if you do that, well, who decides what the target temperature is? And if Russia has a different idea of what the target temperature should be than India has, who decides who's right? And if the target temperature, by putting the 100 megatons of sulfur dioxide precursors up into the stratosphere, not just lowers the temperature, but alters monsoonal rain patterns. Is that something that, if that's something that causes starvation in India, well, was that just an oops, or was that an intentional attack? All of these things that could emerge, these political and cultural and moral risks that emerge from this kind of technology, that the more it's done in secret, the more likely it is that it's going to become a trigger for a much greater conflict.
We're chatting with Jamai Cassio, author of the book Hacking the Earth on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. You know, the issue of transparency in this era, of course, Jamai, as you know, is a raging debate among computer security and cyber terror and cyber war experts who talk about security through transparency versus opacity. And I think we're going to come back to that topic a bit later as we get into some of the issues that you raise in your book, which, as I mentioned in the introduction, is both to me quite illuminating and quite sobering. You've used the word geoengineering a few times. I think now is a good time to define it, and you referred to it a little bit. Is there a standard definition of geoengineering beyond what you've already said?
That's a good question. We're moving towards one, and I think I had a chance to speak to the National Academy of Sciences late last year, actually alongside a number of people who are quite active in the science side of geoengineering, including Dr. Ken Caldera, who's there at Stanford. Mm-hmm. I think the definition that I gave, that is engaging in large-scale efforts to change global climate systems, is probably the closest one to a generally agreed upon. Because there are people who would try to include actions that would change local climate. There are people who would want to include things that are essentially boil down to weather control as geoengineering. And I think the thing that's important to recognize about geoengineering, as opposed to something like trying to induce rainfall, or what China was doing, trying to avoid rain hitting Beijing during the Olympics, is the scale of the impact. If you're engaging in geoengineering, your scale is the whole planet. If you're just changing local conditions, while in principle that has planetary effects, the effects beyond your region are usually pretty subtle. The definition is broad in a way because it allows you to talk about all sorts of different things that could be done to change climate systems. So, for example, one of the other big ideas that people have talked about for a few years as a model of geoengineering has nothing to do with the atmosphere directly, but is actually dumping tons of iron particles into the oceans in order to induce algae blooms. Because when algae you have this massive algae bloom, but among the effects is to suck down carbon dioxide. So the idea being, well, if you can have enough of these algae blooms, you can actually start pulling CO2 out of the atmosphere and ameliorate the effects of global warming that way. It turns out that there are all sorts of questions around that, ranging from would it actually work to what kinds of other effects would that have on sea life, on oceans, et cetera, et cetera. And so the point being that geoengineering can cover a whole range of efforts intended to alter the global climate system. So that's the definition.
Yep, it does. The focus here, and I apologize to listeners as I had to deal with some feedback there. The focus of the book being geoengineering requires that before we get into more of the details of the book, that I ask you the question which a lot of listeners may be thinking of, which is ultimately your perspective. And this is one of those crystal ball type questions, but let's start off this way. Assuming that nothing different is done, that whatever we're doing now we continue to do, and we don't engage in other efforts, geoengineering or otherwise, to address these issues, what is the current view of the impact, and ultimately, how long do we have before we have the kind of climate changes that cause the starvation and the death and the kinds of issues that are often raised as the major downsides for human life in environmental disasters?
Well, that's a much harder question than you might want, because these are really complex systems. It's not just climate systems are complex; it's how they interact with our economy, with politics, etc. There is a case to be made that we are already seeing the kinds of effects you're describing in terms of starvation, rise of new kinds of pests, you know, or pests in areas where they shouldn't have been, et cetera. You know, so we're already starting to see them. I think the consensus view as to when it gets really, really bad is probably somewhere around the end of the century. But that, I think, is wrong for a couple of reasons. It's wrong because all of our estimates in the past have been, you know, we have horribly overestimated how long things are going to take. Every IPCC report that's come out has brought the timelines in closer. And so anything that says, you know, we have until 2100 before things get really terrible, we're probably actually talking 2050. Mm-hmm. The other reason is that it makes it sound as if, well, we can wait until 2100 or 2050 to deal with this stuff. But one of the things I write about in Hacking the Earth is that climate change is something that you can think of not as a long-term problem, but a long-lag problem. It's something where the full impact may not hit for years, but that impact is based on things that we're doing now or have done in the past. You know, there are things, one of the biggest drivers of that is something called ocean thermal inertia. That essentially, the oceans heat up and cool down much more slowly than the atmosphere. So even if we were to stop putting any CO2, any greenhouse gases into the atmosphere right this very second, you know, suddenly all gone, we're not doing it, we would still see several more decades of warming simply from the heat that's accumulated in the oceans. So anything we do now, we have to recognize, isn't going to have an impact for at least 2 or 3 decades. Hmm. And that means that if we say, well, we only have to worry starting 2030, well, that means we have to start worrying now, because we're not going to be, the changes that we're making won't have an impact for 20 to 30 years. Now, this is a problem not just for, you know, how do you figure out how to do all this stuff? How bad will it really get? It's also a problem because human beings have not been very good at dealing with those kinds of problems. Mm-hmm. So we don't have good institutions for dealing with long lag problems. And in fact, you know, my big fear is that when people start to make active changes to greenhouse gas emissions, start making big changes to the environment, we will still see the impacts of global warming. And people will, the inevitable response will be, hey, you told us you were fixing things and now things are getting worse. Mm-hmm. You know, you were lying to us. And unfortunately, that's not how the system works.
And so that gets us to the core of the problem as you see it. From a geoengineering right. perspective, what is the core of that problem? What are you trying to address broadly in Hacking the Earth and in discussing this topic generally?
Well, I think they're several fold. First of all, it's recognizing that geoengineering is trying to bring out the understanding that geoengineering is not a solution, it's a bandage. You know, it's a tourniquet is actually probably a better way of describing it. It's something that can keep us from bleeding to death, to keep us from getting too hot to do anything, too hot to actually start to kill people. But in doing so, it raises all sorts of other problems. And if we do it for too long, it'll kill us. And so it is simply a way of holding back, holding off the worst case scenario until we can get other things set up to be able to deal with that worst case scenario and to ameliorate that worst case scenario. So first of all, is getting that understanding out there that this is something that is not a fix, but is something that as we delay a response, we'll move from being a possibility to a near certainty. And I think we're getting close to that point where geoengineering is the worst possible solution except all the others. Mm-hmm. Because we have to do something to avoid a global catastrophe that kills millions of people.
Interrupt you quickly. How close are we to that eventuality, in your estimation? Before we go back to your answer, what's the best science telling us these days?
It really depends on the science is telling us that it's closer than we want it to be. We can't make a 100% it will happen in 2042 kind of prediction. That's not the way the science works. What we're seeing is that we're already seeing early indicators of what kinds of impacts we'll have. That is, weird disruptions to temperatures. So, for example, there was a massive wheat harvest collapse in Russia last year because there was an extended heat wave, a heat wave that lasted far longer than the normal summer heat waves would last, and it destroyed their wheat harvest. And that was actually the same time there was that extraordinarily long cold wave in other parts of Europe. It was this really weird weather condition where some parts of Europe were extremely cold, other parts of Europe were extremely hot, and it was ruining things all over the place. And that's one of the things that you might start to see more of as global warming gets worse. We're starting to see rainfall patterns, flooding in places that 100-year floods happening every 10 years kind of thing. There isn't a single point where you flip a switch and suddenly it's all bad. It's this kind of incremental, you can possibly blame it on other things kind of a process, which again adds to the complexity of the response. If people can make a case, well, yes, we've seen this happen before, it's not common, but it's happened before, it's not really global warming, then it becomes easy to put off dealing with global warming. This is a really complex problem, and I think the most important message to get out there is that dealing with this problem is not going to be simple. If we're looking for a simple solution, we're going to get into trouble. And that's my big fear about geoengineering, is that people will see it as a simple solution.
We're chatting with Jermaine Cascio, author of the book Hacking the Earth, on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways that you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, it's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu, and from there go to donate to KZSU. So you click on donate to KZSU, and in that way you will get a response from our underwriting department. Regardless of what you do, I do hope that you continue to keep listening to KZSU and continue to enjoy the programming on the station. So Jermaine, quoting from your book on page 34, you address one of the issues that I think is something we should spend some time on, vis-a-vis criticisms of geoengineering. And you also discuss in the book, and we'll chat about in a moment, what options there are for geoengineering and how likely they are to actually exist and ultimately what their impact might be. But quoting you, you wrote, there are those who would dismiss any thought of geoengineering on the basis that it's wrong to conduct a planet-wide experiment in climate engineering. Unfortunately, this neglects the fact that we're already conducting a planetary climate experiment, only we've lost the lab notes, don't have a control, and got massively drunk the night before. We've dumped massive amounts of garbage into the atmosphere with little consideration of the long-term results. Now we get to see what happens. And that's a colorful analogy, but also a very sobering one. I'm curious, to with regard to that quote, it ties into another issue, which I think is an important one, vis-a-vis the problem, which is a point that you make, that environmentalists are viewed as wanting to save the Earth, when in fact environmentalists, in fact, are interested in saving human beings. So perhaps you could explain that view of the environmental movement in connection with this general criticism of geoengineering.
Okay. I've argued, and it's actually in part of the book, that there is a kind of a knee-jerk view of environmentalists that's sometimes encouraged by environmentalists themselves as being tree huggers. That is, environmentalists are there to save the planet, to save the environment, to save ecosystems and fuzzy bunnies. And to an extent, that's true. But it's not just because the planet and the environment and fuzzy bunnies are good things in and of themselves. It's also because we require those things to exist. We require a functioning ecosystem. As human beings, as a human civilization, we require a functioning ecosystem in order for us to continue to exist and thrive. And anyone who considers himself an environmentalist is ultimately acting in the service of human civilization. Conversely, people who are antagonistic to environmentalists are, whether they know it or not, acting against the interests, the long-term interests of human civilization. It's not the most common view, I admit, but I think it's a pretty compelling one, recognizing that human civilization is not divorced from, is not disconnected from the planet's systems, ecosystems, climate systems, etc. And to act as if what we do to the planet systems will have no bearing on human civilization is profoundly ignorant and dangerous. The only long-term responsible perspective, in my view, is to see the planet systems as being part of human civilization systems, intrinsic to human civilizations, and therefore, if you value humanity, if you think that human civilization is a nifty thing, therefore, absolutely critical that we keep these ecosystems, keep these environmental systems thriving themselves. And so it's this perspective that nature is part of us, that the environment is part of us. And when you look at what we've been doing to the environment in terms of, as I say, dumping garbage into the atmosphere and dumping garbage into the waters, ocean acidification, et cetera, we don't have the luxury of saying, well, we can put off dealing with this, or saying, well, we should just stop, because just stopping isn't going to happen anytime soon. So we are stuck in a situation with very few good solutions, very few good answers. The best answer would have been to do something about this 20 years ago, but that's not on the table. The second best answer is to make very large-scale changes to global economic, technological, and energy, urban infrastructure systems. And I think ultimately that's what we will end up doing. But as that description itself suggests, it's not going to be easy. And there's going to be a lot of political pressure to avoid taking those steps, because whenever you make changes along of that scale, there are winners and losers. And very often it's people who were winners in the previous regime who become the losers in the new regime and will do everything that they can to stop that new regime from happening.
No, I was going to ask you, who are the entities or people that are focusing on geoengineering? In other words, is it governments and private industry? Is it other groups? Where are these efforts coming from? We read a lot about China having invested enormous sums of money into renewable energy and things like that. Is that where the future of geoengineering is? And this is obviously a timely topic given the president's recent State of Union address, where he talked about encouraging innovation. As we sit here today, I want to talk about some of the options that you describe under the heading of geoengineering in a moment. But who are the leaders, or where are the leaders coming from, if there are any, in this field?
Okay, so just to be really clear, the geoengineering approach, the geoengineering set of responses, not call them solutions, but responses, are not the regime change I just spoke about a moment ago. Mm-hmm. They're not the ones that are the big shifts. They're the ones that essentially allow the current regime to survive for a while we have a slower transition to the new regime. Mm-hmm. Most of the interest in geoengineering has come from academic circles, people who, scientists who are climate scientists looking at the effects and saying, oh, crap, we got to deal with this, and we may have to do something radical. There have been some groups like the Cato Institute and a few other of the libertarian big business organizations who initially latched onto geoengineering as a way of avoiding having to do anything about carbon, but they got such bad response from the scientists that they have generally dropped that particular argument and now are simply saying it's a way of stopping the problem, you know, or dealing with the problem while we make a slow transition. There have been few national governments that have come out. I don't think there have been actually any national governments that have come out explicitly saying we have a geoengineering program. In fact, when the president's science advisor, John Holdren, made mention of even having geoengineering on the table as something to discuss, like a year and a half ago, there was such an uproar from the people who are largely people who are sort of traditional environmentalists that he very quickly backed off from that. There's been some interest in geoengineering from private individuals with lots and lots of money, most notably and probably most publicly Nathan Myhrvold, former chief scientist at Microsoft, who has up on his website, which I'm blanking on the name of his actual organization, but it's not hard to find, he has this big plan for essentially using a giant hose to pump sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere. And he has the resources to do it, because one of the scary and attractive aspects of geoengineering is that it would be really cheap, you know, relatively speaking. It would cost probably not as much as a shuttle launch. It would be within the budget, not just of the United States and China, but probably of Belgium. Okay, this is not something that is outside the realm of only, you know, all but the most powerful nations. This is something that any reasonably industrialized nations could conceivably do. So that's one of the big scary aspects of that, is because it makes it really hard to control. So the people who've been the most opposed to talking about geoengineering have been the sort of, like I said, traditional environmentalist groups, groups like the ETC group, who essentially claim that geoengineering is just another term for big business and big government getting their hands on the environment and doing awful things to us. And there are, of course, the sort of the fringy chemtrail types who are out there saying that we're already doing geoengineering. Look, there are trails in the sky that proves it. So you have people who are arguing against geoengineering who tend to have a fairly extreme view, saying that essentially this is not just wrong to consider now, but should never be considered, and frankly, even talking about it is suspect. I've actually had encounter people who said that we should not even talk about geoengineering because the very talk about it distracts us from the real goal of cutting carbon. And while I think that's an admirable argument in some ways, because cutting carbon is ultimately what we have to do, it's an unrealistic one because of these long lead time processes, where we, like I said, we could start cutting carbon right this very second and still suffer from really nasty effects from global warming.
So what's the opposition to geoengineering, or the people who you've spoken to are opponents? What is their response to your Band-Aid point? To the point that it buys time to make these changes. Is that viewed cynically as just an excuse for, as you mentioned, a corporate takeover of this issue, or is it something more complex than that?
The ones that have bothered to respond, rather than just simply repeating themselves, which is unfortunately all too common, have said it's a cynical approach, or a cynical step. Others have said that it is, even a bandage is a distraction, that the only goal should be a full-scale revolution in our, you know, planet, our social systems, social, economic, technological systems, and that anything that takes us, that delays that, is inherently wrong. My feeling is, it's fairly gut level at this point, because it's a sense that I'm not willing to. I don't like the idea of seeing the potential for millions of people dying on the basis of taking a strong stand for what's right. You know, I think we may end up having to do something that's not good in the long term in order to avoid seeing large numbers of people die. And that's a really unfortunate thing. It's a really scary step to be considering, but we're rapidly getting to the point where there are no good, no safe, no correct steps left to us.
So, you know, as we talk about, I mean, and again, this is a sobering conversation. You know, I don't hear you saying that all is lost, fortunately.
No.
And yet what you describe is ultimately an issue where an attempt to get any kind of political consensus on what to do, put aside internationally, but even within this country, seems highly daunting when it's difficult to get consensus right now, on any issue, it seems, in the federal government, save, you know, interestingly, things like the START Treaty, which of course do go towards global devastation, if we're concerned about nuclear proliferation or the unregulated, growth of that kind of destructive capacity. How, in your view, and we have about 13 minutes left, and so we can spend a little time on this, how in your view do we get consensus that we need, first of all, to accept the fact that we do, in fact, have climate disruption, to use your phrase? And perhaps that gets to a larger issue, which is the phrase global warming perhaps being problematic. So do you have a view on how we get that kind of consensus before we even get to the question, it seems, of what we do about it?
Well, there's a good scenario and the what's called the sad scenario. The good scenario is that it follows a pattern similar to smoking. And I think I mentioned this in Hacking the Earth, but it's a, if you look at the history of smoking, the culture around smoking in the United States, if you look at 1970, you had a situation where it was considered that was part of being an adult, and a plurality, if not a majority, of adults smoked. And certainly there was, it was accepted. By 1980, people were starting to reconsider, and certainly by 1990, that is, you know, less than a generation, you had a total transformation of society of smoking seen as a taboo, something that was dirty and wrong and would probably kill us, would probably kill the people who did it. And frankly, at this point, they deserve it. You know, this really radical shift in public perception around what was once a widely supported view, even though there had been doctors and scientists in 1970 saying smoking causes cancer, it's going to kill you. The cigarette companies had enough resources to essentially cause sufficient doubt in the minds of the public, who frankly don't have the time and the expertise to go in and dig through all of the science because they have lives to lead, cause sufficient doubt in the minds that the right response of, you know, preventing smoking, you know, prohibiting smoking all over the place was delayed. But that shift happened. It was almost a phase change response where it seemed like nothing was happening, and then suddenly there was a big shift. And you can go into it'd be a really interesting bit of research to look at what were the underlying dynamics of that shift in perspective, because I can certainly see a similar kind of shift happening around carbon, where you have the term that's out there, merchants of doubt, out there trying to do everything they can to cause people cause the public to not conclude that, yes, the climate is changing for the worse. And, you know, so you have this happening, and then suddenly, or seemingly suddenly, there's this shift in mindset where you have a significant plurality of the population saying, no, we have to do something about this now. So, you know, that's sort of the good scenario, that the dynamics are already in gear, and that sometime in the next few years, sometime in this decade, we'll see that really big shift in social mindset in the U.S. The sad scenario is one where essentially it takes a massive disaster that can best be explained by global warming, or can convincingly be explained by global warming, to serve as the quote-unquote wake-up call, that it's something that, you know, that kills, you know, bunches of people. And can, you know, the people reach the conclusion that, wow, this global warming stuff has to be real, because otherwise how did, you know, this Category 5 hurricane hit New York? Or, you know, how did, you know, we have this massive, you know, this massive flood or massive drought? It sort of go down the list of different kinds of environmental catastrophes that could happen. And so that one is sad because it means that a lot of people are going to die. And in fact, would probably require not just one of these kinds of events, but it might require several of those kinds of events happening in fairly short succession to change people's minds. You know, so imagine not just a Katrina, but a Katrina followed by, you know, next year another Katrina, and 2 years later yet another Katrina. Mm-hmm. You know, that kind of thing, where this is totally outside the realm of anyone's experience. And there are people who can explain it, who have been trying to get our attention about this for years. Unfortunately, depends on whether my antidepressants have kicked in, whether or not which one I think is more likely.
Right.
This isn't a situation that where people are just going to wake up tomorrow and everyone's going to have a much more sophisticated view of the world. There's a potential that it could happen. That kind of process could happen in a shorter amount of time, and there's potential that it would require some kind of really nasty trigger. Ultimately, we will have our minds changed in the broader American public, and ultimately we'll have people in office who would actually be amenable to making some big changes. You know, it's funny that you mentioned START. You know, they managed to get START passed during the lame duck session because it's fairly likely, you know, that the current composition of the Senate wouldn't have had enough people to pass it. Mm-hmm. And certainly, if we see the same kind of voting patterns happening next year, the 2012 Senate would not have passed START.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's, I think, a nice analogy. It may be something like an arms control regime that ends up being the working parallel for a global agreement around climate or around geoengineering. But because of this really big hairy mess of, you know, the U.S. being so reluctant and China, frankly, being reluctant, although they're doing a lot with the renewable energy, it's such a tiny portion of their overall energy output, and it's going to be a tiny portion for a while still, because they're still starting up coal-fired power plants. You know, China is going to be a really big source of carbon, and they make the very persuasive claim that, hey, they need to develop, and it's not fair to ask them to stall their development because of things that we did in the past. You know, it's a persuasive claim. Of course, it still ends up with lots of people dead. And so here we have this really troubling, sobering, I think is a good term you've used a couple of times, this really sobering situation where we know we have to act. We can't make a pinpoint prediction of exactly what will happen and when, but we know the kinds of things that will happen over a rough time frame, and we know that some of these things are inevitable because of choices that we made in the years and decades past. And therefore we're left with this question of what can we do? What can we do to prevent, you know, a global catastrophe? And unfortunately, it looks, you know, increasingly, frighteningly likely that we'll end up having to engage in some kind of geoengineering, with all of the corresponding uncertainties about unintended impacts and who's in control and who says when to stop and who's liable when there are problems. With all those things still intact, that still ends up being better than catastrophe.
We're chatting with Jaime Cascio on Hearsay Culture on KZSU FM Stanford. Jaime, we have about 3 or 4 minutes left, where I get to the unfair portion of the show. Although you've covered a few of the issues that I wanted to get to, I do want to ask you, really, ultimately, what is the last question before I ask where people can find your work? With regard to the research agenda that you would advocate going forward, many of the listeners of Hearsay Culture are researchers, academic or otherwise. To what should researchers be doing next to address geoengineering and the broader issues of climate disruption that you write about in Hacking the Earth?
Well, I think the most important things that researchers can do right now, is to develop stronger models of what the potential impacts of different geoengineering scenarios might be. You know, because right now, one of the big uncertainties is just what are the side effects? And in a parallel, what are the steps that we can take that might ameliorate those side effects? And what are the steps that we might take that may not have as strong a geoengineering impact, but still have far fewer side effects? So getting those models down, getting much better modeling done. And in fact, that seems to be the number one topic on the agenda of the climate scientists I've spoken to. The thing that needs to happen outside of the climate science community, though, is for people to get educated. You know, it really comes down to people needing to know what the debate is, what conversations are taking place, because you can't make good decisions in an information vacuum. You know, and unfortunately, there's too many things out there for people to feel like they can be knowledgeable on everything unless they have a job like mine.
That's right. And are there, with regard to, again, many in the audience who are lawyers or attorneys or law professors, is there any role that you see for research or law in this area?
Oh, actually very much so. Mm-hmm. In fact, one of the better articles about the politics of geoengineering was actually written by, I believe his name is David Leonard at the Stanford Law. Mm-hmm. So Stanford's been pretty good at this. There are definitely issues around the politics and the legal issues. The very question of liability. How do you determine liability when you can't make a precise determination of cause? You know, so just as we can't say 100% that certain storm was caused by global warming, similarly you can't say with 100% certainty that a particular drought would have been caused by geoengineering. So how do you determine liability in situations like that? How do you determine how do you determine who's in charge? How do you decide what the mechanisms are for control over these kinds of global decisions that can be undertaken by individual actors?
And, you know, to an extent, like I said in earlier, I've written a bit about trade secrecy in this context and written recently in an article that's coming out in American University's International Law Review on the impact of trade secrecy with respect to the dispersant used by BP in the Gulf to deal with the Gulf oil disaster, which, again, is I think, broadly geoengineering in the sense that this, or maybe not, but I can get your quick reaction in 30 seconds, is what BP did in putting Corexit into the oceans, the kind of geoengineering about which we should be concerned and no more.
Well, we should be concerned and no more. I wouldn't consider it geoengineering because it doesn't have a deep global impact.
Oh, okay.
But it's a nice analogy. Mm-hmm. It's the kind of thing that I think people can understand and sort of wrap their minds around. You know, think about BP doing this to the entire ocean. Well, that's what you're talking about with geoengineering.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We're chatting with and really ending our discussion with Janae Cascio, author of the book Hacking the Earth on KZSF from Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Janae, for those people, and you mentioned it earlier, but to mention it again, for those people who want to learn more about you and your work, where can they go?
They can go to openthefuture.com, openthefuture.com. I'm also a research fellow at the Institute for the Future, IFTF.org. I just want to say that despite all this, I am an optimist. I really am. I do think that we're going to get through this century and we'll have a better planet than we had at the beginning of this century. It's just not going to be easy.
And I think I want to close on that point on a surprisingly up note, given the topics that we talked about here, and certainly invite you back, Jamay, on the show. I've enjoyed the conversation, and obviously this is an issue that we can only just really begin to discuss, even in the long format of Hearsay Culture. So thank you for taking the time today, and I invite you back and look forward to following your work. I found Hearsay Culture, like I said, to be extremely illuminating and readable, and I appreciate you taking the time to join us on Hearsay Culture.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and I'd be happy to come back anytime.
Thank you much. I'm excited to mention the remaining guests that are coming up for this quarter on Hearsay Culture. We have a few more shows left. Next week, a slight schedule change. Professor Shiva Vaidyanathan of the University of Virginia will be on discussing his new book, The Googleization of Everything. Rounding out the quarter will be Professor Andy Hiley of Elon University School of Law, my colleague, discussing online sales taxation, an issue of particular importance to states as they attempt to generate revenue. And at the end of the quarter, Professor John Taranian of Chapman University School of Law, author of the book Infringement Nation. There are a number of guests upcoming after the end of this quarter and the hiatus, which exists for a few weeks before the schedule commences. And so you can find that schedule as well as all previous shows by going to hearsayculture.com. As usual, the best way to listen to the show is live on KZSU from 11 to 12 a.m. on Tuesdays Pacific time. But you can also get the show from hearsayculture.com as well as by podcast from Stanford Center for Internet and Society's iTunes page, as well as the webpage for CIS, which is cyberlaw.stanford.edu. Incidentally, for those of you who listen regularly, I've gotten feedback from time to time asking that the show's title list the guest, and that change has been made with thanks to Joe Nito and Elaine Adolfo at Stanford Law School, who are the wonderful team that posts the show and really put it into podcast form, and I appreciate their hard work as well as the work at KZSU and the DJs that man the board, as well as our program director and our chief engineer. So thank you for listening to the show today. I hope you enjoyed it. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.